So it's my pleasure to introduce Xiaomi. Just arrived, was it today or last night?
Last night.
from California.
So yeah, he's
jet lagged enough that we can make a bit of fun out of him. Xiaomi did, you know, just by way of introduction, did his undergrad at Cornell with Repi. Some of you might know the famous superfluid torsional oscillation experiments. And, you know, super solid was a big thing back, I guess, when Xiaomi was doing undergrad.
Recording in progress.
There we go. People missed the start of that intro. So it's kind of fun that he got some experience on the old dilution refrigerators and the old torsional oscillator experiments and so on. Xiaomi then went to Princeton for his PhD, and that's where I lost track of his bio, so I'll just say the rest is history. Now he's at Google on the hardware team, right?
Yeah.
Google Research in Santa Barbara, and he's going to talk to us today about kind of the quantum supremacy, I believe, experiment, right?
Yeah, well, and other things, yeah.
Welcome to Primer, thank you so much, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Roger, for the for the introduction and invitation for me to come here. So today, well, there's an overall theme of which is about the quantum supremacy paper, but then also it's sort of a hybrid talk, which would be divided between some introduction to the experimental platform we have and some, experiments that we've been recently doing. And there will be a second one, on Thursday, which will be about other things. Just a quick introduction to our team. We're pretty big now, over 100 people overall. This is actually a picture that's kind of a few years old, taken right before the pandemic, so it's a bit smaller back then. Nice. This is actually in our Los Angeles office. They have a pretty sunny deck there.
Now, how many offices do you have?
So we have three. Mostly three. So there's the Santa Barbara team, which is mostly about experiments. There's a Los Angeles office, which is about theory mostly, and then we also have a small presence in Seattle, where they have software engineers and other people working on cloud. So I guess the talk today will be divided into three parts. I'll begin by introducing superconducting circuits and how we might use them as qubits. So this will be more of a hardware talk. And then I'll kind of talk a little bit about this kind of by now famous experiment of what's called quantum supremacy back then, but now we're only allowed to use the term beyond classical for various reasons. And then there's this relatively more new kind of experiment that does studies actually the physics underlying the quantum, the beyond classical experiment, why this works, how do you detect this thing with local observables and so forth. So let's begin by talking about what quantum, what superconducting qubits are and why they're cool as qubits. Of course, we know that superconducting qubits are not the only qubits out there. Really, nowadays, you can grab any two-level system and make it a qubit, right? And they kind of essentially comes in as a wide spectrum. On the very left, you would use some sort of a naturally occurring atom or particle as your qubit, like trapped ions or neutral atoms. They're nice in the sense that they have very fixed frequencies. They have very long idle times, but they usually suffer from the sense that they can be slow and hard to parallelize gates as well. So there's pretty much for each one of these blocks, you can have sort of advantages and disadvantages. Somewhere to our middle, you would have things like NVA centers or linear optics, which are kind of the coherence of not as long as these things, but then they can be faster and sort of advantageous in other ways. On the very right are my favorite things, right? So on top is actually what I did for my PhD, which is studying the spins of electrons in semiconducting quantum dots. So these can be very long-lived, and they are actually very much like CMOS sort of electronics. And at the bottom is what Google and we have been focusing on, which is actually using superconducting circuits as qubits. So this will be my focus today. So what is a superconducting qubit, or specifically, what is a transmon qubit, which is the most sort of commonly used type of superconducting qubit? So it's really at the bottom of it, it's just a nonlinear oscillator. So you would have an inductor there, characterized by inductive energy, EJ, and then a capacitor, EC here, with a charging energy of EC. So there's a quantum, you can write down essentially the Hamiltonian of the quantum circuit, and that we have essentially a charge operator, and this conjugate a flux operator. And these prefactors are the associated energies. So you notice that here, the phase operator comes as a cosine. So this is a bit different than a typical harmonic oscillator you might see. And that's actually why this can be used as a qubit. So just as a picture of what these things look like in real life, so these inductors are actually made out of Josephson junctions, which is actually essentially two pieces of aluminum with a thin layer of oxide separating them. Right? So depending on the current flowing through it, it actually has essentially a nonlinear inductance. And if you put two of these in a loop like that, then you can actually tune the Josephson energy, the EJ term, through an externally sort of applied flux through the loop. So this is basically comes down to a voltage, which tunes this effective energy. And the capacitor is very simple. It's just a regular capacitor fabricated in a planar kind of structure. Okay. And if you solve the Schrodinger equation of this thing and write down the energy levels and also the potential, it looks like this. So rather than having a harmonic potential, this is a cosine potential. So what happens to the energy levels, they're not evenly spaced, right? So the fundamental transition energy is from the zeroth level to the first level is characterized by the qubit frequency, omega zero. From higher up, each level is sort of offset in transition energy from this fundamental transition by amount eta. So this is called monicity of the qubit. So now you can see that because the energies are different, you can actually isolate the fundamental two levels and make that your two-level system acting as a qubit. Okay? So that's why this cosine potential and this Josephson junction is quite important for making this to work. Now, how do you address this qubit? So on a hardware level, what you would do is to drive qubit rotation, make it transit between the zero and one levels. You would essentially feed one of these lines and drive the charge operator with a microwave. And this allows you to rotate the qubit. And if you shape this microwave carefully, you can achieve a pretty high fidelity, usually in the three nines for single qubit gates. So this is pretty standard nowadays. And for reading out the state of the qubit, what you do is you couple this nonlinear oscillator into a harmonic oscillator, which is fabricated as a coplanar waveguide resonator. So it's basically a transmission line separated by two capacitors. This makes it basically a harmonic oscillator. Now, if you probe this harmonic oscillator with a probe tone, depending on whether this up or down, the frequency of this thing shifts by a little bit, right? And you can detect that shift by essentially looking at some sort of a microwave voltage out of this probe tone. And looking at the difference, you can tell whether it's up or down. And we can typically read out the state of the qubit with 97 or 98% fidelity. Okay, so all this is pretty standard in transmon literature, but I think the real innovation that kind of comes into the architecture we have at Google is actually how you do two-qubit gate. And this tends to be the bottleneck for most experiments in quantum information processing, because these tend to have low fidelity. So the key to engineer a good two-qubit gate is the following. So you have two qubits to start with. So we actually couple them through what's called a tunable coupler. The way it works is this is actually another qubit, which is not drawn here, but it's just another transmon qubit, but has much higher frequency. So it does not directly get entangled with other two qubits, but it's still kind of close enough to have some sort of dispersive shift in the frequency of these two qubits. And if you write down the Hamiltonian in the effective two-qubit subspace of these two qubits, there is a coupling term, G, which can be tuned by the frequency of this middle transmon, right? So in terms of the full Hamiltonian, it looks like something like this, where you would have the individual qubit Hamiltonians and a variable coupling rate G for these two qubits. Now to make this more familiar, in qubit land, you would truncate this Hamiltonian into the two fundamental levels of each one of these qubits. And that actually looks very familiar to people who work on many-body physics or some sort of condensed matter physics. And this is basically a Heisenberg XXE model, where for two qubits, you have a XX plus YY interaction, which are equal in strength. And you would also have a ZZ interaction, which is actually there, which is actually stronger if you have a lot of coupling. So the prefactor of this term is essentially 4G squared divided by this harmonicity term. So by cranking up G, you can make this term strong as well. So we can actually do an effective Heisenberg model with our qubits, right? And this is the key for the flexibility of these gates, because with a single pulse, if I let it just interact for a certain amount of time, I can essentially engineer an I-swap gate or a C-phase gate or anywhere in between. So this is very easy and very flexible. And as far as hardware is concerned, usually the easier the pulse scheme is, the better your gates are. And just to give you a sense of how it looks in practice, this is some very recent data which shows that we can actually tune through the entire regime of this so-called FSIM gate, which is a composition of I-swap and C-phase with high fidelity. So these two color plots are basically the swap angle for that I-swap gate and the C-phase angle, the conditional phase for that CZ gate, as a function of the amount of coupling you have between the two qubits and the duration of the pulse. So you can see that by changing this over, this is, mind you, this is still very short. It's only 20 nanoseconds or so. And this, we can tune it up to 60 megahertz or so. By exploring this landscape, we can basically go anywhere between a full I-swap to no swap and between a CZ gate and essentially no CZ gate. So it's actually possible to do the full family of gate, and we have demonstrated very recently that you can do it with above 99% fidelity on a large chip. So, but knowing how to do the gate is just one thing. What's actually crucial, especially for NISQ type of applications, you have to actually know what you did. What that means is that you actually need to be able to characterize the output unit tree of a pulse with very large precision. This is not a trivial task, because for commonly available methods like tomography, for instance, these are very heavily influenced by spam errors. So you can actually mischaracterize these angles by a lot. So one thing that we worked on is really figuring out the appropriate sort of characterization scheme that allow you to characterize two qubit gates precisely. And this is done by basically repeating this unit tree many times. And by inserting certain transformation in between, you can selectively amplify just one matrix element at a time. So notice that there are five generic parameters characterizing the possible unit tree. So the key is to have a pulse scheme that amplify one of these things, but leaving the other things unchanged. That way you can always fit your output to a single parameter. And for experimentalists, that's the only fit we trust. So this is a key to this thing, so-called locate calibration that we kind of come up with. So just to see how it works in practice, right? So you take the output, take your gate. If you want to know exactly what the I-swap angle is, you would simply try to kind of set these other matrix elements to as close to zero as you can, and just repeat this unit tree many times and look at the probability 0, 1 or 1, 0. And you can see these oscillations by doing a Fourier transform. You have a very narrow peak that indicates exactly what is the swapping rate between the two qubits. So this is one example to show how we would characterize this angle. And if you want to characterize these other angles, what you would do is to kind of come up with these kind of various schemes with different initial states and so forth that carefully amplify just one of these angles, right? You see this line fits and these data points are basically the accumulated phase for just one of these parameters. And from there, you can fire up your circuit to various, to a variable depth and fit things to a line. And from the slope of it, you can extract each one of these angles to very large precision. So this kind of so-called Floquet calibration is actually quite crucial for a lot of our recent experiments. So from these, you can really know these kind of angles up to the drift of the device. Okay, and just to kind of to show you what this thing can do for you, this is a recent paper last year where we studied, the single kind of particle band of an 18 qubit ring, right? So we essentially realized an XY model and try to understand how close we can resolve the eigenfrequencies. It turns out for even such a big system, we can resolve the eigenfrequency up to 10 milliradian or so. This is actually characterized by the drift of the device, not the inaccuracy of the calibration. So this is already pretty much limit, it's the state of the art number you can come up with in terms of gate accuracy. So yeah, and for a lot of the talks on Thursday, we have relied on this scheme to do our algorithms basically. Now, let me kind of transition to the second part of the talk, which is actually, now with all these things in hand, what can you do with the device, right? So, well, the first thing you do is you can come up with some sort of a contrived task to try to beat the classical computer if you can. And this is basically what was done a few years back with this particular experiment. And I will just try to walk this through and see how it works before we delve into the physics of this experiment. So the key of this so-called quantum supremacy experiment is basically a random circuit sampling task. So basically what you do is you compile a random circuit. And here you would have essentially interleaved layers of single and two-qubit gates, where the two-qubit gates are as entangling as it can be. In this case, it's pretty much like an isolated gate. And this is, if you look at the Schmidt decomposition of that, it's as entangling as it can be for two-qubit unit arrays. And then you would do this random single-qubit rotations, which are kind of have a random axis of rotation. They're always pi over two pulses, but they have a random axis. So this thing basically, in the parlance of many-body physics, scrambles everything, right? So, it's designed to be chaotic. But running the circuit, begs the question, how do you characterize it, right? So for things like randomized benchmarking, you can invert the whole thing and try to look at the return probability. But in this case, we do not want to invert the whole thing because the whole point is to actually make something complicated so you cannot simulate. So the question is, how do you characterize output? So a very simple way to visualize what the output might be in different limits is actually to just plot out the probability of each bit string, in a landscape sort of way. And there's a very dramatic difference between what a quantum output might be and what a broken processor might give you. If the processor is completely broken, then everything is equally probable because it's an infinite temperature state. So you just get a flat line, which looks like a lake. Whereas if it's quantum, completely quantum toward the end, you would have what's called a Porter-Thomas distribution, which looks like a grass, right? Instead of having this floor here, you have a lot of spikes. So this is kind of the typical output landscape for a Porter-Thomas distribution. And in real life, with our quantum processors, you have something somewhere in between. For this orange lines are what you actually get out of an experiment. So you still see these spikes, but they're more washed out. But they're also not completely broken in the sense that you just get uniform distribution. So now the question is, okay, we have all these different limits. To challenge a classical computer, you have to have a notion of fidelity. Because what ends up happening is you characterize your fidelity, and you would hand it to the best classical computer scientists and say, with given this amount of computational resource, how good can you simulate this? So you have to have a notion of fidelity before you talk about supremacy or anything else. So, and it's unclear how you would define it. And even more unclear because sampling the entire spectrum takes a lot of samples, right? With 12 qubits, 12 qubits here, it's already 4,000 states. If it grows so much beyond that, it's just impossible to actually characterize the entire landscape. So it's kind of unclear how you would actually fish out the fidelity of the quantum processor if the system size is too large. So there's a very neat trick. There's a quantity you can define, which is called linear cross-entropy fidelity. And this tends to have very nice properties. So the way you would define this is actually not try to approximate the entire landscape. You just take your circuit, right? A few thousand or a million times something you can handle, and you just collect a sample of bits, a collection of bits, and bit strings rather. And for each one of these bit strings, you would plug into a formula like this, where it cross-checks the probability of that particular bit string you just got with the probability that it will show up in the ideal distribution. And by sampling by averaging this over a sufficient number of bit strings, you come up essentially with a fidelity number bounded by 0 and 1. So this feels a little bit like magic to begin with because the bit strings themselves don't have much of a meaning. Only probabilities have much of a meaning. But it turns out this actually works in practice quite well. It's just to show you how it works. This is a 16-qubit cross-entropy benchmarking data where we only sampled each random circuit for different depths 20,000 times. This is actually smaller than the Hilbert space, right? And from there, you can actually compute the cross-entropy fidelity, and it shows a nice exponential decay that corresponds to the product of all the gate fidelities pretty well. So it's, you know, the take-home message for cross-entropy benchmarking or XEB, that it's very efficient for estimating fidelities, even if the Hilbert space is very large. This is the key for us being able to verify that we have supremacy is to have a way to estimate the fidelity without having to sample the huge Hilbert space. Yeah. And then just looking at this, you might realize if I go large enough, then the circuits might be impossible to simulate. How do I check the fidelity in that case, right? So there you would rely on something else. So basically in this beyond classical experiment, what we did is we, instead of try to sort of simulate the actual circuit we run in order to verify its fidelity, which is impossible to begin with because those are hard circuits, we came up with different variants of the circuits which more or less have the same number of gates, but we kind of tweaked it in a way that you can simulate, right? So some of them are just a cut in the middle. Some of them are kind of omitting a few select gates. And one of them is actually applying the two qubit gates in a different sort of pattern. All of these can be simulated. So, and then we kind of fix the number of circuit depths and look at what the fidelity does as a function of the system size. So quite remarkably, all of these circuits give you the exact same decay curve. So all of the fidelities are decaying more or less on a single line as a function of number of qubits. So this gives you a confidence that if I tweak this circuit at the 53 qubit level to something hard, it's not going to deviate so much from this line, right? So now you actually have a fidelity estimate of what you can do at a 53 qubit level. And all you need to do is to run something that's hard and hand it over to the computer scientist and ask them how long it will take you to simulate this particular circuit up to a certain fidelity threshold that I have in experiment. And that turns out to be quite long. Of course, you know, the caveat is this keeps improving. So this is not a God-given curve. As all of you might be aware, over recent couple of years, people have come up with more efficient ways to simulate this or build better supercomputers. So this is not going to be always the case, but there's our hope that as our quantum processor, you know, kind of gets improved, we'll always stay ahead of the curve. Okay, so this kind of concludes this part of the talk, which is kind of about quantum supremacy. I think I'm still doing pretty well on time, so if you have any questions, now is a good pause to ask. Otherwise, I will just proceed.
You showed a lot about the scrambling, right? So there's some transition between noisy and Porter Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know the transition is at some which trim? I mean, how does that decide it? Like till 4,000 on the x-axis, plot, right?
I'm not sure what exactly you're asking.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do I understand this?
Oh, this is just a visualization of the different extremes for a processor. So this dashed line is a zero fidelity limit where you just get nothing. Everything is the same. This really spiky thing is the ideal limit if you have fidelity one. In the intermediate case, which is what you always have, you'll get something with spikes, but not as sharp as the original distribution. So this is just a visualization of the system, yeah, if you will. Any other questions?
So maybe just so like the blue curve is like your target distribution, but if you have any error in
that, it will be different than that.
Drastically changes it, right?
Yeah.
That's the point of the cross entropy.
The point of the cross entropy is to allow you to compute overlap between the orange and the blue without having to go into the trouble of computing this and measuring this entire spectrum. Yeah, that's where it becomes useful.
So John Martinez always said this was motivated by like speckle patterns in lasers.
Yeah.
Give us your take on that.
Yeah, so you can plot this in a 2D pattern. I forgot what the axes are. It looks like a speckle. It's just a visualization thing.
And the idea is if you have kind of one error in the
an error will shift the speckle.
The entire speckle pattern.
It remains the speckle, but if you average over different errors, that speckle goes away.
Oh,
So in our quantum process, the error is not always fixed, right? So it happens over a, you know, time-dependent fashion. So that would destroy the speckle if you average enough. Yeah, a single error, if it's a fixed error, it just changes the speckle. It doesn't destroy it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So in just historically, was that really the motivation behind this?
Historically, well, the motivation of the thing is, well, twofold. In one case, we want to design something that's hard to simulate. In the other, you know, case, the cross entropy comes, you know, XCP came in because we want to verify it. How do you get something computationally hard and also be able to verify it? So that this is the scheme you essentially came up with. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now I'll go into a, you know, more recent experiment where I actually try to understand the physics of this kind of random circuits, if you will. So what makes it work, you know? And also I kind of view this experiment as a transition into the next era, because as you just saw that this is not particularly useful for any application, apart from maybe random, you know, number generators. Here we actually are trying to transition into something more useful. So why is the beyond classical experiment not so useful? Well, the reason is following, right? So what we just did was we take some simple initial state, we fired up a complicated unitary evolution, we came up with a huge sort of Hilbert space. What this beyond classical experiment or XCP is trying to do is try to sample from the global state of this thing. Which actually, because you cannot sample this much of a dimension, you just came up with a bunch of bit strings. There's nothing you can make use of, right? These are just bit strings. So this is why this experiment is not particularly useful going forward, at least this way of doing measurements. So now you ask yourself, what are you actually interested in as a sort of NISQ person? So what it turns out to be, you know, for most physics or chemistry applications of quantum computers, what you're interested in is typically local quantum observables. You take a huge system, you don't look at everything. You look at what happens to things locally, right? That, I think that covers probably 90% of the type of algorithms you have ever studied. So we need to make a big transition here to go from a global state of the system into local quantum observables. Now you ask yourself, how do I make this transition whilst preserving the computational complexity of the original problem? So basically, what we decided to study as a first step, and the talk on Thursday will study other things, is to look at this phenomenon, which is closely related to quantum chaos, and that's called quantum scrambling. It has a formal definition. It has to do with the spreading of local quantum information into the many-body nature of the system. And it's also kind of useful by itself, because this really underlies a lot of things. You know, in quantum gravity, you have this black hole paradox, or SYK model, all these things have kind of scrambling as its kind of core. And in condensed matter physics, you know, quantum scrambling, or otherwise known as thermalization, is really the favorite hunting ground for AMO physicists for many years. You know, all these papers are essentially study how fast the system scrambles, how it thermalizes. And you have also, you know, in some sense, there are certain quantum phases like strange metals or, you know, these things, they have a scrambling or some sort of anomalous scrambling at its core. So it has a lot of applications as well. So this is kind of the phenomenon, NISQ phenomenon, that we decided to study as a first step after the other experiment. Now, why is this thing also kind of preserves original flavor of the other experiment? Is because scrambling is related to chaos. Even in classical chaos, we know that it's sort of the key to the computational complexity of these systems, right? So typically in classical systems, you have integrable systems where you can sort of collapse the system into a certain set of integrals of motion. But once this gets destroyed, everything starts to explore the phase space and things become hard to compute. And the nice thing about this is that also you can study with local observable. In classical systems, you would focus on a subpart of the system and look at what's the so-called butterfly effect, right? So something flaps its wing, so the local observable gets changed dramatically as time goes on. So this has a classical analogy, but also quantum scrambling is more interesting in the sense that this analogy is not quite complete. So in quantum scrambling or quantum chaos, there are really two different mechanisms, right, that needs to happen before the system go complex. what's more familiar to classical physicists is the idea of operator spreading. So how this works is that you would start with the local observable. Over time, this thing gets kind of transformed into more and more non-local operators, sort of delineated by this Lycon structure here. So the operator basically is spread from a local point into essentially at some point the entire system. Okay, and this has been studied quite extensively in literature because it can be mapped to hydrodynamics. And exactly because of this map, it's not so interesting to look at this by itself because everything is solvable classically. But this is not the only thing that defines complexity, at least in the quantum world. The other thing needs to happen in conjunction with operator spreading is the idea of operator entanglement. So a way to potentially visualize this is that not only does this have to spread in real space, this initially local operator also has to kind of evolve in operator space into a superposition of many, many operators. So more concretely, you can think of a classical example, which is Clifford dynamics, which we'll actually study in this experiment. But Clifford is not complex, right? Because we know that it can be simulated in polynomial times. And what happens with this circuit is it tends to transform a local operator into a non-local operator. But if you look at just the poly string, it remains a single poly string. So for Clifford dynamics, this happens, it can be maximal. This is minimal. And Clifford dynamics is easy to simulate. So in other words, to really sort of nail down quantum scrambling and show its presence, you have to be able to characterize both things in your system. And this has not been done before. Right? Most of the time, people focus on this thing, but not this. And it's actually unclear how you would even visualize this. So this is the tricky thing we're going to try to capture. So the observable that sort of captures both of these things is the so-called out-of-time order correlator. Let's look at the definition first, which is kind of a mess, but at least for me. But so what it is, it's basically a four-point correlator, which are kind of out of time, or rather out of order in time. You see, there's this O operator, there's this M operator, has their daggers, but they also kind of, some of them are at their initial time, and then some of them are time evolved version of that. So this is kind of, this thing, it turns out, actually captures a lot of the physics of scrambling. Okay? It looks like a mess, but what it really is, it's just a commutator between two local operators, an M operator and a time evolved O operator. So this is really just related to the commutator between these two things. And a lot of the interpretation of the data can be done by just thinking of commutators. And the way you would measure this thing in experiment is actually have to reverse the flow of time. So you would try to sort of start with a unitary, a big unitary that sort of covers the whole system. You let it evolve for a certain amount of time. You apply a perturbation. This butterfly thing here is just the O operator. And then you let it evolve backward, okay? If you look at the middle block, this is basically a time evolved version of the original operator here. So this basically does the OT thing. And then you kind of, there's the ancilla qubit that gets coupled to another what's called a measurement qubit. This whole mess, all this seeks to do is to characterize the overlap between the measurement qubit somewhere, there's M, and the time evolved version of this butterfly operator. So it looks like a mess, but really, this whole thing is meant to capture the commutator between two qubits where they're all local operators over time. Okay? And the unitary we choose to study for this is pretty similar to what we just did for the beyond classical experiment, which is kind of, again, random single qubit gaze interleaved with ISWAP gaze, or actually in some cases squared ISWAP. Okay? We choose this because it can be inverted. The inverse of ISWAP, you can do that pretty easily with local Z rotations. So now let's first focus on a 1D system. So if I do 20 qubits and apply this butterfly operator somewhere successively down the chain, denoted by these colors, and keep looking at what's happening to the observable, namely this OTOC toward the very end of the chain, I get a series of curves that look like this. Okay, So you see that as I apply this butterfly thing away and away from where I'm observing it, where I'm measuring the autarch, the decay started, there's a bit of a cliff here that started to happen at later and later times. This is of course understandable because the Lycon needs time to propagate. But what's kind of miserable when you first look at the data is everything started to decay right away, right? Because there's noise, there's decoherence in the system. Everything decays out pretty quickly. And for this last qubit, for instance, it has already decayed below 20% or so of its value before it even start to feel the edge of the Lycon. So this looks terrible because if it goes any larger, there's nothing much you can do with this kind of experiment. What's really kind of key thing about this experiment that we figure out a way to actually back out the ideal part, the ideal dynamics of this whole chunk. And this is done by essentially looking at a reference circuit where you basically take out the butterfly. So this basically does a Loschmann echo and gives you a line, which is this gray line sitting on top of it. In ideal cases would be just a flat line one because it's just echoed everything out. But in reality, it's subject to the same of noise influence as the other things, right? So it has a line like this. And it's more or less the circuit fidelity. So you see that after 24 or whatever cycles, you only got 1% signal left. So now what you can do is you error mitigate your signal by dividing out each one of these curves, the color curves, by the reference circuit. And this actually factored out the more or less exponential contribution of noise. And here you got this kind of beautiful picture of commutator, right? So everything stays perfectly commuting with the butterfly operator until the Lycon edge has reached here and the two overlaps and no longer commute. So it suddenly does the drop and then it recovers something very close to zero. So this is actually, a first demonstration that you can sort of really error mitigate your signal, at least local observables, very, very nicely with our quantum noisy quantum computers. So now you kind of start to explore further and see how this maps out in 2D.
Sorry, can I ask one?
Yeah.
So, sometimes above one, it means that the butterfly actually reduced the noise level?
Yeah, so this is just, there's imperfection in the inversion. So the error mitigation is not 100% perfect. So sometimes you just have measurement error, for instance, where you cause this to go a little bit below what it should be. And when you divide out these two things, it shoot a little bit above one. So there's certainly still some remnant error left. But it's doing a lot better than this thing you're looking at. Yeah. Okay. So now we can sort of start to explore this thing in 2D. So this is actually the data taken with 53 qubits. Oh, one thing I should mention is that this is looking at average autarch. So instead of looking at just autarch for select random circuit, I'm measuring this over an ensemble of random circuits. Okay. That's why you get these nice signals. And this only tells you operator spreading, which I will show you in a second. But let's look at how it behaves in 2D. So basically here, again, I'm plotting the 53 qubit system, the autarch value associated with that. I'm sort of measuring always here. Over time, you see that the Lycon propagating in a ballistic manner. As you have more and more cycles, you have more and more autarch value kind of dropping below one. Until after 15 cycles or so, the Lycon has covered the entire chip, and every autarch has dropped close to zero. So you see a beautiful picture of operator spreading in 2D. And the fact you have such clean data is all owing to the fact that you can normalize and factor out noise this way. And you can do something cuter and try to slow down the dynamics a bit more and try to make the gate, instead of I-swap, you make them squared I-swap. Here, due to the hydrodynamics a bit different, so meaning that the spreading is not ballistic anymore, but rather diffusive. And you can see that in the data here. So it's no longer a very fast propagating wave, but rather it kind of has a tail, right? Over time, it only spreads out in a diffusive manner. So it's just a cute thing to look at. But unfortunately, as I mentioned before, operator spreading does not give you computational complexity, meaning that all of the things, despite how pretty they look, they can be simulated rather easily. So it turns out, again, you can map them to hydrodynamics, and without having to actually simulate the quantum circuits, you can just use solve the corresponding what's called population dynamics and figure out what you're expecting. And you can see these dashed lines are prediction from population dynamics or hydrodynamics. And these solid lines are what we measured out of the experiment. The agreement is very well, which is great for validating your quantum processor, but terrible for applications because now you don't need to use the quantum computer to figure out what's going on. So what turns out to be hard is operator entanglement. That's not something you can attack with hydrodynamics. But how do we measure it to begin with? So here you need something else. So instead of looking at the average OTOC, which is again this kind of solid purple line here, which basically drops to zero pretty quickly for isolated gates. So instead of looking at that, you're looking at the fluctuation of OTOC between different random circuits. So what's hiding behind this thing, this other purple lines are actually the OTOC value for individual circuits before I start to average them out. So now you see this seem to behave quite differently than this other thing, right? Namely that they don't quite drop to zero very quickly. They have a huge fluctuation which dies out over time. So this turns out to be something that is hard to simulate. And I will tell you exactly how hard they are. And they give you information about operator entanglement. But to see how it's related to operator entanglement, you have to kind of design an experiment that does that to actually fish out that particular aspect of quantum scrambling. So to do that, we actually try to engineer our random circuit board a bit more carefully. So you see that for the quantum supremacy experiment, where all the data I just showed you, we actually choose this single qubit gate indiscriminately. So basically, they can be rotation around any axis. But you know that, as you might know, that some of these rotations, they're Clifford rotations, some are not. Namely, these x and y gates, which are rotating along a cardinal axis, these are Clifford gates. But the ones that are rotating at other axes, they're not Clifford gates. And the isotope itself is a Clifford gate. So you can actually start up first, you divide out, you kind of classify your gates differently. And now you think, oh, how do they change my operator entanglement picture? So basically, for Clifford operations, you see that if I start with a single poly string, the isotope can cause the poly string to spread, so more non-identity gains. It can cause this kind of poly operators to flip. But you see, a single poly string always remains a single poly string. Okay? But as soon as you start to apply any of the non-Clifford gate, the string starts to break up. It evolves into a superposition of multiple poly strings. And the number of poly strings, roughly speaking, is related to operator entanglement in the system. And we have full control over what gate we apply. So now you can actually design a series of circuits that apply a selective, increasing number of non-Clifford gate to control the amount of operator entanglement and see how OTOC fluctuation is related to that. And just to visualize how it comes out to be, this is basically plotting the OTOC value for single circuit. So each one of it is a single random circuit, but with a fixed number of non-Clifford gate. So as you go from left to right, you have more and more non-Clifford gate rotations in your circuit. You see something quite striking. At the beginning, because it's a Clifford gate, the poly string ends up, the single poly string ends up as a different poly string. You measure the OTOC, it either commutes or anti-commutes with the ordinal operator, so you get plus or minus one. It fluctuates between the different extremes, but it's always plus or minus one binary. As soon as you inject one non-Clifford operation, it starts not just be bounded by those two extreme values, but rather can assume values in between. So namely, its fluctuation dies out. This is massively fluctuating. This is a bit less fluctuating. As you inject more and more of these non-Clifford operations, you get a dying out, essentially fluctuation. Eventually, at 32 non-Clifford gates, it's very little fluctuation left. So now I can process this data and look at two different things. I can look at the average OTOC value as a function of the number of non-Clifford gates, or I can look at the fluctuation of these things as a function of the number of non-Clifford gates. You see, this is always zero, pretty much. So the amount of operator spreading is more or less unaffected, as you expect. Whereas this has exponential decay, more or less. And in the inset, I'm kind of plotting the number of poly strings I expect out of the evolution. So you see that there's a direct correlation between the OTOC fluctuation
and the number of resulting polys of the circuit. And from this, you can actually sort of directly relate this to the operator in terms of entropy. So maybe there's actually now an interesting kind of experimentally accessible observable, even local observable, they can use to probe this really elusive phenomenon operator spread entanglement. And what's even more remarkable is that these agree with numerical simulation really, really well. So you see, this is already a 53 qubit circuit at depth 12, I think. So it's already kind of close to what we just did for the supremacy experiment. There you have a fidelity of, I don't know, 0.2%. But here, with proper error mitigation, you see how well this outcome agrees with the calculation. So it's really, again, another illustration of the power of error mitigation, right? And here as well. So now, the last thing I want to just briefly touch is, okay, so while this looks convincingly well, so the question is asked if we already have, you know, let's say, beyond classical performance from OTOC measurements. Unfortunately not. So we really studied these things quite carefully over time, and we found that unfortunately with local quantum observables, classical simulation become more interesting. So there are ways people come up with that allow you to sort of simulate observables like OTOC more carefully, more efficiently. So instead of having, like, let's say, just around 350 days where you would already cross into the beyond classical sort of regime, you would need more like 450 entangling days in the ISWAP in order for the local observable OTOC, in this case, to be challenging. And for us, even with careful error mitigation, the SMR goes to 1, around 250-something gates, so we're maybe a factor of 2 away from this frontier in terms of fidelity, but hopefully we'll get there soon enough. I think that more or less concludes my talk. Just to recap, so I introduced the hardware and showed that with our hardware we can sort of, for certain very contrived tasks, prove that we are at least on par with what a supercomputer can do. And from there we moved on to the NISQ era and try to kind of study local observables and try to understand the physics of the dynamics from local observables alone. And we showed that with proper error mitigation, even these observables can be simulated to very high fidelity compared to actually the original fidelity of the circuits. So I think these overall are very good news for using quantum processors for kind of physics-related discoveries in the near future. And if you go to the Thursday talk, I will actually talk about two models which are more familiar to condensed matter people. Yeah, so this is still studying on circuits, but we'll study other things on Thursday. And yeah, of course, this is not done by myself, so there's really a whole team of support for all of these experiments, and you know, to highlight a few people, Adam, Chris, Charles, and Yichen are, they contribute a lot for the OTOC experiment, and on the theory side, we have Igor and Kostya who worked out a lot of the theory underlying the population dynamics, and NASA has been doing a lot of heavy lifting on the simulation side. And I'll take some questions people have, and just by the way, I'm staying here until Friday. I have an office somewhere upstairs, or maybe on this floor. So welcome to drop by an email and just drop by if you want to talk to me, and we'll talk about these other experiments on Thursday. Yeah. And yeah, I'll now read the questions.
Questions from the room, or?
So I have a basic one. So what's your definition of quantum supremacy then? Because as far as I understand that there were doubts about this, and you reformulate as a beyond classical because the task is like purely quantum and it's kind of, I don't know, unfair to compare.
Well, the definition of it? It's just, while you take a circuit and observable, you have a way to know what the fidelity of that thing is on your quantum processor, and you benchmark that with classical simulation and ask how much time it will take to simulate that observable up to that fidelity. If it turns out to be possibly wrong, you call it beyond classical. If you want to follow that definition.
So, I mean, that was the definition for beyond classical. And what's the definition for quantum supremacy
then?
It's
the same thing, we just screen it due to quantum rooms. My guess what those are. But,
Yeah. Is there a quantitative relation between the OTOC fluctuations and the operator integument, or is it like more of a heuristic?
So not for generic dynamics, unfortunately, but certainly for the class of Clifford versus non-Clifford evolution, there is a formal definition, there is a formal relation. In fact, if you look into the D30-page supplement, we actually related to the OTOC fluctuations to the operator integument entropy and to something else. There's a direct correlation between those.
Okay.
But only for that class of circuit. Yeah. So other things are a bit tricky.
And one more question about the hardware part. So you said that you have this Floque measurement of the parameters, but and I didn't understand. Isn't it like destructive for the system?
Yeah, it's not destructive. It's more like I can go back to that slide. It's more like constructive interference. So the whole trick of this okay evolution is you think of this matrix, right?
Yeah.
You want to know exactly what one of these parameters are.
So what I mean after that.
Uh-huh.
Do you stay in the same state of the system, or you have to build the system again?
So after you have figured out what happened, we typically have models that translate, let's say, a pulse parameter into one of these things. If you know they're a bit off, then you bring your pulse a little bit differently. You redo this after you convert this after a couple of iterations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned error mitigation. Could you elaborate like what kind of error mitigation like you did use for the chaotic experiment?
So
you mentioned the experimental resulted matched quite perfect with the simulation after error mitigation. Like what kind of error mitigation techniques?
It's just dividing things out to speak apparently. Yeah, so all it does is, if you look at the raw observable, everything decays out immediately, even before the light one even strikes the observable.
Uh-huh.
But, so you want to know exactly how much of this stuff is due to noise, and how much of that is actually due to scrambling. A way to separate them out is to have a reference circuit where you literally invert the circuit without applying this thing. You get this great thing. So this decay is completely bounded by noise. So all you need to do now is to divide each one of these curves by that particular curve. And that's the error mitigation step.
Okay. So this error mitigation is is not a general
method. Well, it works for other dynamics too. So in Thursday talk, where I'll talk about this particular thing, time crystal implement. So there we use the same trick.
Oh, okay.
So it turns out to be working there as well. I mean, to some extent. It's not never perfect, but it's better than nothing.
I see, yeah.
Okay, I don't see any online questions. Going once. So maybe just flip your last slide real quick. Jaume's here for the whole week, so email him to get on his visit schedule, or if you forget to write this down, just email me and I'll set you guys up. And we'll be going, some of us, to IQC on Thursday for the second talk, so looking forward to that. Let's thank Jaume again.